General Nimril 5. I suppose one of the most common criticisms of staff work during the First World War, which is the kind that one reads the most often in the history books, is this whole question of how much the staff who were responsible for the planning and conduct of operations knew about the actual situation at the front where particular operations had to take place, and knew at the time that the operations in fact were taking place. So that I suppose an objection to occasional visits to the front would be the argument that surely it's vital that there should be an awareness of the conditions at the front at the time the operation is going to be carried out, because it's only at the time one knows whether the weather conditions, for example, militated against its effectiveness. How would you reply to that?
Well, you can't change a large operation at that sort of short notice in a trench warfare attack on a front of, I mean, if it's going to be any good, it was in those in that war. You had a trench warfare attack on a front of 10, 20 miles, involving 4, 5, 15 divisions, and the zero hour is fixed, and whatever the weather, unless the weather got so bad that the army commander decided to stop the whole thing, the looking at the weather just before zero hour couldn't. You couldn't change a rule to the thing. So that the visit of some senior staff officer to the front of his formation just before the hour couldn't affect an operation like that. It's impossible.
How long do you think it would take for an operation of that scale to be called off? I mean, if 0 hour is 8 a.m., at what point before 8 a.m. on a large
Well,
scale attack would it be feasible to call it off for any reason?
probably 5 or 6 hours.
5 or 6 hours.
Yes, because it's got to go from an army headquarters to corps headquarters to divisional headquarters to brigade headquarters to all the gunner batteries. The artillery brigade, of course, and out to all their batteries. Although there are signal lines and so on, it's a tremendous, tremendous link-up of things that's got to be stopped.
Of course,
And
in
on top of that, troops spread out. They've all got to be the infantry are probably out in their assembly trenches. You won't get signal messages to all of them. They've got to be runners to get out and so on. Tremendous business. It's very difficult to stop a really large scale thing at the last minute.
Even so, though, I mean, at times like Passchendaele, for example, I mean, the actual ground conditions there had been extraordinarily poor and were known to be poor, and to militate against the prospects of success in an operation like that for weeks before the attack took place.
Yes. Well, that of course is a question of whether it was ever fit to carry out such an attack. The demands of I forget all the details of that. You see, the demands of assistance, I think that was assistance. The French were screaming for help and said there must be a diversion made, and the Passchendaele was the thing that had been decided long before to relieve risk to the Channel ports, something of that sort, you see.
Yes.
And There it was. If they'd mounted an attack somewhere else on better ground, there it is. Mm. But that's that was appalling state of affairs there.
Can we finish with this particular question with just one more point? From your personal experiences as a staff officer at various levels, were there any aspects of the system which you thought were deficient at the time, or think in retrospect were deficient?
The system of what, of command or passing orders?
The staff system, the system of communication.
Well, the system of communication is never as good as one would like. It's always being improved on. You see, we hadn't got all the wireless that we've got nowadays, which has speeded up things tremendously. Mm. And the signal communications in the trench warfare it depended on signal wires. Sometimes it was possible to bury them and sometimes it wasn't. And shelling cut these things. Mm. And you might find yourself cut off from headquarters up near the front. All that was the weakness of it. So that I would say that the system of command was not perfect, owing to the difficulty of maintaining communication. Mm.
Do you think that more frequent visits to the front lines by staff officers would have helped this situation at all?
I don't think so, because in places where I know a division that I was with, where one did have frequent visits to the front line, it wouldn't help this question of signal messages getting up any quicker. You knew what the situation was in the front, all right, by these frequent visits, but it still wouldn't have improved the communication system. Nowadays you're better off with your wireless.
I was just thinking whether it would enable oral communication to replace the deficiencies of the signal communication.
Well. Only that, I mean, somebody who's been to the front line, he doesn't get back to his headquarters for an hour or two. He crawls back, walks back these muddy communication trenches. He's got a long way to go before he gets to a car and gets onto a muddy road and so on. It's a slow business even then. Mm.
Good. I wondered whether you saw much of the work of the chaplains during the First World War. I'm particularly interested in how frequently they visited the front lines.
Well, I don't know that I can tell you much about that. I don't think I saw them in the front line. We had an excellent chaplain at the CRE's headquarters in the 8th Division. The short time I was adjutant RE, he lived in our mess, and he was a first class fellow. And I know he used to go and visit the troops and so on, but I can't say that I saw much of chaplains up in the front.
Were they generally well regarded in your experience?
Yes, I think so. Never. I mean, I attended outdoor services at intervals, but so far as their work, absolutely their work up in the front, I don't recollect much about it.
I think we may well have dealt with this subject earlier on, but in general. Can you give me any idea whether you had an opinion at the time about the abilities of the senior army commanders?
Oh, yes. Well, I can, because I've met a number of them. I had a very high regard for Haig, although I never worked under him, but I met him on many occasions when he came round visiting the troops, and he was always had this reputation of being so shy and so on. But well, I can tell you a little story about him. When we were working, I was constructing one of the first strong redoubts behind, close to our front line, not far from Neuve-Chapelle, and this was regarded as rather a showpiece. I was a subaltern then, and my CRE brought several people up to see this, amongst them Sir Henry Rawlinson, who commanded the corps, and then he walked all round it and was very interested. I'd known him in peacetime on Salisbury Plain, and actually he knew me because he'd seen me win a point-to-point race on Salisbury Plain. Then Sir Douglas Haig, who commanded the First Army in which we were, he came up, to my surprise, and while he was there, I was showing him round. The Germans started shelling. They did every morning about 11 o'clock. We were quite used to it. And shells went over this, and some came fairly near. We were my sappers and a small infantry working party we had on it too were quite used to it. And one of Haig's staff officers, I don't know who it was, got very fussed and nudged me and said, "Hurry up, hurry up, let's get the army guard away." Haig took no notice and went on walking round even slower than before, if possible, and asking questions of me, and then even talking about camouflage from the air and that sort of thing. It's the very early days of any air observation, and went the whole way round this pretty big redoubt, and then slowly walked off down the communication trench, quite unmoved. Well, that was the first time I met him, and after that I met him several times coming round inspecting troops and so on. And as I say, he had this reputation of being shy, but I never found it. And when he got amongst the troops, he was absolutely natural and spoke to the officers or the men just in the right way. And I regarded him as a very great commander. Absolutely determined, quite unmoved by any difficulties or reverses and so on.
Do you have any more little stories about him from any of your other meetings?
Oh, well, no, only this is rather rather swank. When he came to inspect, when I was brigade major, he came to inspect our brigade. They were doing training, and he inspected one of the battalions, and he had his chief of staff, Lieutenant General Kidsall, with him, and my brigadier, Brigadier General Locke, was with me, and we rode round this exercise. And then as Haig was going away, he congratulated us on the troops and what they were doing, and then he turned to Kidsall, and he knew Locke because Locke had been with his when he had a corps, I think.
Yes.
And Locke had had won a DSO.
Yes.
And Haig turned to Kidsall and said, "Well, we'll go now, Kidsall. Here's." He was talking, he'd been talking to me, that's why he addressed me first. He said, "Here's Neame been winning his VCs and his DSOs, and here's Locke winning his DSO." He said, "They're a fine pair." He said, "Now we'll say goodbye," and he rode off.
Do you remember any other meetings with that you had with Haig?
Let's see. I think...
apart
oh,
from
I was going to say, then the high commanders, I made to make a note. Yes, Rawlinson. I knew Rawlinson. I mentioned him. He, of course, commanded the Fourth Army, and then Horn, the First Army. I knew him. He was a very sound soldier, rather silent and unforthcoming, but everybody in his army had great faith in him. He was a very determined man and a very steady man.
As far as you were concerned, then, the senior army command was fairly well respected.
Oh, yes.
And their abilities were judged to be of a pretty high order.
Yes. As I say, Gough, the Fifth Army, I mentioned before, he was the only one that I ever, you know, heard doubts about.
Fine. During the period that you spent on the Western Front, did you hear many rumours about the kind of things that were going on at home? Were there many rumours sort of circulating around the front about what was happening at home?
No, we didn't hear chat of that sort.
Yes. When you went home on leave, what was your impression of the... When you were at home on leave, did you find that your family and friends had a very accurate picture of what was going on the Western Front?
Well, I think my family did fairly so, because we used to get a fairly regular leave home. I forget what it was, every 6 months or something like that. And one wasn't